test taker code 014. This is Dimitris Giakas, technical assessor and user IU language assessor. As a team, we're going to conduct the FAES2F examination according to the ICAO language proficiency requirements. The examination will last approximately 40 minutes. Briefly, the exam consists of three tasks: the open questions, talking about pictures, and the listening comprehension task. It is very important that if you do not understand something during the test, that you ask us.
Okay.
Please tell me a few things about your job.
My job, as you know maybe already, I'm a major in Hellenic Air Force, and for the time being I'm serving in Gallegiechen Air Base, NATO, flying for AWACS. My previous job was in here in Greece, flying for Hellenic Air Force also, in Andravida Air Base, the F-4 fighters.
What do you like about your job?
What I like the best for my job is that it's very interesting, like flying and having a lot of adrenaline. And the other thing is that I see a lot of places around the world, and with E3As I had the opportunity to do that a lot of times.
Will you please tell me if a highly automated cockpit weakens the traditional flying skills of a pilot?
I think it is, and that's why I'm very I fully support that the new pilots should fly first hand flying airplanes, and then they can jump to a more automatic cockpits, because it will give them the principles of flights. And in an automated cockpit, maybe they won't have this opportunity to see it in their careers. So, because my previous experience, it was also in hand-flying aircrafts, and also now the aircraft that I'm flying is hand-flying, more or less. So I fully support this opinion.
The companies nowadays make airplanes which are fully automated in the early stage. Do you think that this is a problem to the new pilots?
No, it's not a really problem, but I believe that the thinking behind this is that the companies, they would like to have the safety to make the airplanes safer than they were in the past. And because the human factor is one of the major factors of the accidents, and that's why they are trying to make it as much automated as they can, so they can take out this factor from the accidents in the years that they will come.
Efficient communication between crew members is a key factor in assuring safety. What's your opinion about that?
I think this is a fundamental reason for the safety, because if you cannot communicate with the guys that they are inside the cockpit, then you lost your crew members, and I think that the safety goes out of the window, and this is a major factor on accidents as we have seen in the past.
Have you faced any problems in your new squadron in Gallegiechen with multinational crew?
This is a nice question, because this is the biggest experience that you will face in Gallegiechen. This is the thing that that you have to face, guys from all over the world, maybe Canada, United States, all over Europe, and that's going to create a lot of challenges in communication, because everybody is speaking in a different way, the English language, and also they have a completely different culture from you. So yes, I face problems, but we have also the CRM classes in Gallegiechen, and also we had a lot of time for introduction and to start communicating with the guys. That created a lot of opportunities to see their culture, and after 3 years I feel that I can understand them much better than what I was in the past.
What would you do if you had to face a flight crew member incapacitation?
I will try. First of all, I would try to avoid this situation. If I couldn't avoid it, then I have to take it case by case and to see how I will face this problem. I think this incapacitation has to do with a lot of reasons initially, so you have to avoid it first. If you will come to a point that you have to face a problem like this, then the situation is becoming too much difficult, and yes, you need to be there and to see why this is happening and how you can overcome this problem.
Do your standard operation procedure have any cases or training so to be well prepared for such a situation?
Not exactly. Not exactly, because a military specification airplane. So what the military tries to do is that to avoid situations like this. It's not like the civilian. I don't have the civilian experience, so to know if a situation like this is common in a civilian operator, but for a military, no, I haven't faced this problem. So I'm not sure what I'm going to do not right now, but I'm going to tell you that I will try to avoid it. I know how to avoid it, and I will try to avoid it.
Will you please tell me if you have ever experienced an in-flight emergency?
Yes, I did a lot of times, and yes, more or less with the airplanes that I was flying, they were a little bit old, so we had a lot of problems with the hydraulics, so we faced more or less a lot of emergencies like this. So I did about arrestments twice with the previous jet and in difficult airfields, but yes, that was the point, and I think that we were, in military at least, we were very well trained about facing common emergencies, if I can say that, and sometimes a little bit more complicated emergencies that the civilians are not dealing with.
Have you ever had to return to the airport immediately for any reason?
No, I haven't.
Can you recall the worst case of emergencies you have faced in Korea?
The worst one was, yes, it was with bad weather conditions. I was flying from Skiros Island. I had the full weapon and a full fuel airplane, and I didn't have any hydraulics. I have a very young co-pilot with me, and yes, I had to return back first to land the wing command, and then to come back and land in Skiros. That it is a little bit hard to land there with bad weather conditions, and also to do an arrestment with a full fuel airplane. That was the worst. But to be honest, it is a common thing in my previous jets. In the one that I'm flying right now, no, I didn't have any problems or any emergencies, and yes, that was the worst that I can recall.
How do you deal with military flights?
Military flights. Can you explain a little more in detail what you mean with this?
Operational problem with the operational procedure.
The military flights are a little bit complicated, if I can say that, because you have to face also the the rules that everybody is following when he's flying in the air, but at the same time you have a task to do, and you have to combine these two things that sometimes are not, you cannot combine them. And yes, we are facing this in the GNC, we are facing this daily in our flights, that we are trying to do the job as much as we can according to the rules that the civilian are following, but yes, sometimes you have to deviate from the path, and you have to see the task that you have. And then, yes, the task is the main thing for the military flights. It's not only the flying phase.
Just at the military airport, a few years back, I was surprised when the controller asked me if my gear was down and locked. Something always asked for the Air Force pilots in final. Is the controller considered part of the crew?
Not exactly, but he is considered as a part of the mission, if I can say that. If you will consider the military tasks or the mission that a military air force has to do, everybody in this organization has to play a role on this task. And that means that everybody has to try to augment the safety, and that's why the controller asks you about the gear down a lot. That's why you will see in some military aerodromes that we have the contact card, as we call it, that pilots are in the beginning of the runway looking the state of the airplane that is coming in, how is he, if the gear is down low, if he forgot something. Because as I said, military aircraft is not just flying an aircraft, it's also a task inside. And the task sometimes is much bigger than flying the aircraft. So after 1 hour of flying, doing aerobatics or basic fighting maneuvers, coming back, maybe your mind is not so focused on flying the aircraft for small details as you think that they are not. But usually what we are calling in the Air Force is that, okay, how we are going to take off, this is standard procedure. How we are going to land, this is standard procedure. But how we are going to do the mission, this is the briefing. And this is the difference between maybe sometimes from the civilians. The thing is to land and take off the airplane and then to do the transition. But in the Air Force, it's a little bit different.
Is that a safety measure for single pilot aircraft or also for a multi-pilot?
for multi-pilot, I cannot see the difference between a single pilot aircraft over multi-pilot, because from my experience I have seen that even multi-pilot aircraft have made big mistakes. So I don't think it's only for the single pilots aircraft.
Even when traffic is very limited, both runways are used at the Athens International Airport. Given the fact that there are urban areas near the vicinity of the airport, why do you think this is?
Time is money, as they say, for the civilians. So that means that if they can land or take off airplanes earlier than what they are scheduled or with no delays, I believe that's why the airport is using both of the runways. And yes, we must do some considerations about all of this stuff. Like, I know that the civilians outside the airport will be complained about the noise or whatever, but this is the main gate of the country, and we have to show to the tourists or to the other guys that they are using this airport that this is the airport that they can use, and they can be sure that they won't have any delays. They will use this airport with no problems, and that's why I'm completely, how can I say, full support this decision of not making any delays to the airports, because yes, maybe we'll have bigger noise if you will have more delays.
Do you follow any noise abatement procedure in your squadron?
Yes. Yes, we are following the standard noise abatement as they are in the AIP of Germany. And I think this is also common for ICAO. It's very close to the ICAO rules.
What's your opinion about the hazard of burst during takeoff?
In Greece, we have a lot of incidents with burst strikes. So I believe this is after the human factor, maybe it's the second factor that creates a lot of accidents. Maybe not a fatal accidents, but real emergencies in the aerodromes and the jets. And I have seen a lot of bird strikes, especially in places like Canada with big birds that they drive to a big fatal accident. And we have lost also big jets from this.
Have you ever experienced?
With the big birds, no, but smaller, yes. And I have seen the damage that they do in an engine or in a jet.
Okay, let's go to the second part now. We're going to show you a picture.
Okay, what I can see here is a private jet on the runway with no landing gear, so that means that this guy had a problem of lowering the landing gear, or he forgot the landing gear, but he managed to stay in the runway, and I believe that everybody survived from this one.
Do you think that it's a real situation or a real event?
Excuse me, say again, please.
Do you think that it is a drill situation or a real event?
No, it is a real event, because I can see that the propeller is also has a damage, and they didn't. This airplane was sit there after the landing, the first landing.
And this is the second picture. Have a look at it again.
Okay. What I can see here is something like an Airbus, a commercial aircraft, having also an emergency landing, I believe somewhere close to the water, because I see it on very close to the water here. And from what I see also, it was not fatal for the most of the passengers, because I see the doors open, so that means that a lot of guys they escaped from this. And yes, I don't see any engines on it, and maybe it has to do with this Hudson River accident or something like this.
It is Hudson River?
Yes.
Do you think that the crew followed all the procedures?
I think that they followed all the procedures, but they were also lucky at the same time. So these are the two factors that they drove to this successful emergency landing, that it is one in the, not in the million, in the thousands maybe, that they managed to do this very nice first landing. But from what I know also is that this pilot was very calm, and he faced the situation very professionally.
Do you think that a search and rescue mission in circumstances like that is a critical for?
It's critical, but from the other thing is that you never know when it's going to happen and where it's going to happen. And I believe that the most of the guys are focused, let's say, in the aerodrome area, or something is going to happen inside the aerodrome area. And nobody would have imagined that an aircraft can land in Hudson River, and they have to run there and rescue people from this river. And they were also lucky, because it was not so winter, so it was not so cold or and they other guys, they help them, like civilians with other boats. And yes, I think an aerodrome must open their horizons and to see that the emergency can happen not inside the gate, but outside also the gate. And they must be prepared to face that.
Let's go to the third task now. Mm-hmm. You will listen to the first audio. And after it, we will ask you to tell us what it is about.
This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource of pilots and aircraft owners.
Hello everyone, this is Paul Bertarelli reporting from Vero Beach, Florida at Piper's headquarters. We're continuing our visit here at Vero Beach to discuss the new Piper jet. I'm in the cockpit of the jet with Dave Schwartz, who's the chief of flight test at Piper. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Oh, you're welcome.
Piper, for all of its existence, has been a company that has certified only propeller-driven airplanes. Now we're sitting in a jet, so you have to invent a test program to certify that. How did you do that, and what's the basic description of that test program?
Well, with the J1, what we call the J1 test team for the jet, we went out to the field and we hired in a lot of experienced engineers who had past experience on them, approving, certifying jet aircraft. And personnel, we were able to put together a team that had a vast experience level over various disciplines for a jet program. The process so far has been a very smooth process into the transition from propeller airplanes into the jet thus far.
What are the differences and similarities between testing the typical Piper propeller aircraft versus a jet? Higher speed, obviously.
Higher speeds, a little bit better performance. The stability is a little bit different from a propeller airplane. And of course, the landings are a little bit different. You know, we don't have a big, especially on the prototype here, we don't have any type of means of slowing the airplane down on the runway. We don't have that big prop out there anymore, say, speed rate. So we're gathering a lot of good information on the POC on exactly what additional features, such as speed brakes, lift dumpers, etc., that we will want to be able to add on to the production airplanes.
Okay, I'll go ahead and give you some seconds when we are ready.
Okay, that was a journalist going to a Piper company and looking for the new Piper jet, and he was talking with the test developer how they are going to face this test procedure, because Piper company usually produces propeller aircraft, and now they have a new jet aircraft and they were trying to find out how they are going to do this test in the new jet with no experience in the jet aircraft.
Are there any difference between the piston and the jet aircraft?
Yes, the guy in this he mentioned about the spooling thing, and also the speed, the landing distance, and the devices that the jet aircraft has to have and to compensate these factors.
Let's listen to the second one.
Welcome to Aviation Safety Magazine's continuing podcast series. Today we're talking about unusual attitudes. And with us today is Greg Lewis, Deputy Director at the National Test Pilot School in California. Greg, if you would, please tell us a little bit about the National Test Pilot School.
National Test Pilot School is, as far as I know, the only civil test pilot school in the world. There are six other test pilot schools, all military. Two U.S. military, Navy and Air Force, one in the U.K., one in France, one in India, and one in Brazil. But our school has been was formed in 1981. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary last year, and we do flight test training for people all around the world.
So, Greg, I think everybody would like to hear a little bit about your background.
I joined the Air Force after college, master's in aero, then pilot training, 20 years in the Air Force. During that 20 years, I attended the Air Force military test pilot school, later instructed there and enjoyed it, and that's why I'm here today. But I did 20 years in the military doing flight tests, 11 of those years at Edwards Air Force Base in California.
So define for us, Greg, if you will, an unusual attitude.
An unusual attitude is when you exceed the boundaries of normal flight, typically inadvertently. If you do it on purpose, purpose, then I think we'd call it acrobatics or intentional spin training. But if you inadvertently get into an unusual attitude, that would be the problem area.
So how does a pilot just flying along find him or herself in an unusual attitude in an upset situation?
Probably the single biggest cause is, flying inadvertently into IMC conditions. VFR pilots inadvertently pressing on deteriorating weather and getting into a condition where they're not really equipped with training to press on.
And what would be some other causes?
Could be things like upsets induced by wake turbulence or mountain wave activity, or just a distraction.
So,
okay, that was a visit from a journalist, I think, to the National Test Pilot School in California, United States, and was asking a guy there about what is the National Test School and some other things about the unusual attitudes. That was the main reason of his visit.
Was it a civilian one or a military one?
He was in, that was a civilian school, and yes, that was a civilian school.
What was the instructor background?
The background, his background was as a military pilot for 20 years, and then and also a test pilot in the military, and then he joined this military school, this test school.
Do you remember what was his main concern about the unusual attitude?
His main concern is that you have to be trained to get out of the unusual attitude, this is what I understood, and He stated also some reasons why you can come in an unusual attitude, and his concern was like the guys that they are doing that and they are in an unusual attitude, if they are not well trained, then they will face difficulties to get out.
Let's go to the third
clearances, if I can be more specific, and some rules about this, and how the IFR traffic how the IFR traffic is deconflicted each other between.
What are the methods of airplane separation?
Yeah, this separation is via altitude or route, so that means altitude change or route change, and this is going to be the separation from the traffic.
014, thank you for your participation on the FASO EFA test. The results will be announced to you through the FAS approximately in 3 days.
Thank you very much.